Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you for joining us. Getting back at it, and pumped, ready for the most scintillating hour of finance radio. Darren, we could be doing this show 20 years from now, and you'll still be laughing, which, you know, I probably shouldn't be. That's kind of a slap in the face, really. But, you know, I deserve it. If I'm not getting it from Darren, I'd be getting it from somebody else. But, I am coming with rare energy today. Got back with the missus from Cabo last night, and got to do, you know, I don't like sitting on a plane any more than the next guy. I do like sitting in a lawn chair by the beach, though. That's, you know, no complaints there. But, you know, the nice thing about it is I get to catch up on so much research. And, you know, there's so much research for this job that you have to do, right? And a lot of it is on things that your clients, you know, currently own. You got to do maintenance research. You got to stay up to date. You got to make sure you know what's going on. And that stuff is like working out, right? You got to know what you own. You got to keep an eye on things. You got to keep an eye on the balance sheets and the news and all that other kind of stuff. And it really takes the place of a lot of the research that you'd like to do. You know, stuff that's interesting. You know, that might sound weird to you guys, but, you know, there's just so many different levels. You know, for instance, I love reading economic reports about emerging markets, and we've talked a lot on this show about it in China. A lot of that is not directly applicable to what it is that our clients are currently investing in. Does it play a role? Sure. But, you know, you got to learn how to prioritize this stuff. So anyway, long story short, one of the things that I really love about getting time off like that and vacation is, you know, I get to listen to the things that are more interesting. I get a deep dive into the things that, you know, I'm naturally drawn to as opposed to the things that I need to be doing. So, and, you know, we look at that too. But anyway, just came back with so many things to discuss. Markets, obviously, over the last week, not a lot's changed. We've continued to push vertical here. And really starting to challenge what it was that we've been talking about on the show for the last month and a half. You know, I still don't think we're out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. But I will say this, that there is absolutely zero fundamentally about this market and this economy that justify this move. I think that what happened in December is much more closer to reality in terms of economic outlooks. And remember, that was a 20% drop. It's not fun. But again, when we go back and we look at a market that's gone nothing but straight up for 10 years on very, very weak economic output, and we've discussed why that is till we're blue in the face, not going to get back into that. But, you know, markets do not go straight up. Trees do not grow to the sky, especially not in straight lines. So we're not saying that I think, you know, look, this market, this economy would not deserve right at this moment some type of cataclysmic 60 or 70% decline. That is not where we are at. Now, I'm not trying to make that argument, okay? I know that there are shills out there that are trying to make that argument. And why? You know, the negative side of investing has always been more sexy. And it's something that I've had to keep an eye on myself, okay? It sounds smarter. You know, when I get on TV or you get on the radio and sit there and go, well, you know, I think things look pretty good, Bob, and I think people should just buy and hold. Okay. You know, it makes better theater hearing the guy that tells you, look, this is about to blow up and da-da-da. And I've heard comments on the show, you know, and we've talked about this before, where clients go, Zach, you know, I'm with you. I see all the problems you're talking about. Why don't we just sell everything, you know, and just bear up and look, because we're highlighting the problems, and it's because all anybody else wants to talk about is the upside, right? That's why we jokingly refer to CNBC as bubble vision. So one of the reasons we do that is just because there aren't that many outlets to hear what the problems are. And in investing, and this is the funny thing about investing, is we need to have, you know, vision. We need to have, you know, we need to be optimistic, because that's how we see out in the future and extrapolate potential returns in the future. But I kind of think that that's inherent. And so one of the things we've always talked about is, you know, when I'm looking at things first, as somebody that manages money professionally, and I believe that everybody should look at this first, is, again, going back to the title of the radio show, Know Your Risk Radio, right? Regardless, we've got to know the risk that something presents and the risks that we're looking at in our own lives and retirements and it's, you know, et cetera, to define whether an investment is appropriate. And then if we determine that the investment may be appropriate, how much of that investment should we have? And that is all based off of a risk analysis. And that's one of the reasons we talk about the risks, because the risks should play a much bigger role in how we're investing. Because the whole purpose of investing, right, is to finance our retirement, to finance our living costs. So the first thing that we have to do is make sure that those costs are financed. And yet that's not what we do. We often focus on how we can make the most money. And that's a great thing. Don't get me wrong. We want to grow client accounts. But what do we have to do? We got to work back our Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? The number one thing that those investment savings have to do is they have to be there, right? They got to finance our lifestyle. And does that mean we can't have any of it at risk? No. We can have money at risk. We need to. We know that stocks have been the greatest wealth generator of all time. That's common sense. But we know that we should only have so much, right? How do we determine that amount? Well, there's a lot of things that go into that. It's not just a static, formula as the other investment firms would have you believe. It's not just sticking your numbers into a spreadsheet and seeing what number gets thrown out. What we need to consider is the risks that the investment poses, the biggest risks that your life poses, right? Potential medical costs, you know, grandkids costs, all those different things. And then we need to sit there and go, okay, how would we position? Let's take care of what we know, and let's position as conservatively as we can on what we know. And then the question clients always stop me in the process and they go, okay, so how much in stocks? Based on that. And I said, well, the other thing we have to consider is, what kind of value are we looking at? What are the price of these stocks? How expensive are they? Do we think we're getting a good deal? Because, and this is something everybody forgets about. Listen, the very nature of value investing, and if you think about this in simple terms, I think it'll make perfect sense to you. And it's one of the reasons we pound on it so much. The less I spend for anything, the less risk I inherently have. Okay? I'll say it one more time. The less I spend, the less risk I have. Right? It's pretty common sense. Everybody wants to look at an investment and go, we're going to define risk on what is the likelihood that this investment drops or goes up. Okay? There's an aspect to that. But we also know that over long periods of time, which is how we should be thinking and investing, that's the other thing. I don't want to get off course, but the short-termerism, the short-term thinking that has become so prevalent, and it's always been there to some degree, but I've just seen it ramp up in my career. It's just deadly. It's really deadly. People looking at returns over 6 month, 18 month, even 24 month period of times, it's worthless. Those are the same people that wanted to fire Michael Burry in The Big Short in 2007, right before his fund was about ready to make 1,100% returns. Right? And you see it in investing all the time, that typically your biggest wins will come with periods of time where you know, you're taking it in the shorts a little bit, right? You're underwater because that's where all the opportunity. And this is a tough topic to get on over the radio show, but it's the part of value investing, and it's the part of investing that everybody always fails to look at. I've told the story, and I've heard this 100 times, but I've told the story on the radio before where a woman looked at me and she goes, why do you have that in your portfolio? Those things haven't done very well over the last 5 years. And I kind of looked at her and paused and said, that's exactly why we have them in the portfolio. And she just didn't get it. She kind of looked at me with this quizzical, you know, look like I was just blowing smoke. But I said to her, I go, I don't want to buy things that have already gone up. And in order to buy things that haven't gone up, you have to buy things that haven't performed well. That's why they present value. And that gets back into the whole risk analysis process that we do, and the way that we look at things is valuation very much plays a role. Because the less I pay, the less I have at risk. You know, and Boeing stock, perfect example, right? I've been saying Boeing stock's overvalued for a long time. It is. It's gotten more, and it could and can continue to get more. Right? People go, yeah, but it'd go to 500. I go, you sure could. And they go, well, why don't we buy it? And I said, because it's historically ridiculously priced. And there's nothing into the fundamentals that justify the tripling that the stock has had over the last 5 years or 3 years even. It's just gone parabolic. It's grown like a tech stock. It's insane. And it's no knock on Boeing. They're the best in the business. Great company. I think the management's done a really good job. I don't agree with how they're currently allocating capital. They're doing a lot of these debt finance buybacks, which I think are going to come back to really hurt these companies. But what's the biggest reason? The valuation. It's just insane. Paying a 25 price to earnings multiple for an industrial stock whose revenue has basically been a flat line over the past 4 years and the stock's tripled over the same period of time. And that's what this market is full of. And it doesn't mean it can't go higher. And that's why we always sit there and go, you know, I either get two comments typically. It's Zach, it seems like you're trying to play both sides of the fence, or Zach, it sounds like you're so bearish. And usually they're right after each other, right? So if one guy tells me I'm too bearish, the other guy's telling me I'm playing both sides of the fence. On the both sides of the fence comment, you should always be playing both sides of the fence in this business, because nobody, including me, knows which directions markets are going over short periods of time. Over long periods of time, I think that you can, within reason, make pretty good projections that have pretty realistic outcomes. And we just see that through historical examples, right? However, in the short term, nobody knows. There's too much variability. And it's one of the reasons I'm always careful not to sit there and go, look, hey, I don't have any special insights anybody else has. Just as it relates to the financial advisory world as it exists, we just look at things in much greater detail. We do much more research. We pay much more attention to balance sheet quality and balance sheet health and cash flow statements and, you know, all the stuff you should be looking at in order to make, you know, good investments and successful investments. So anyway, I've already gone off on a tangent a little bit there, but let's get into the market update. We're already running long here. What did we look at over the last week? Gold has continued to have a really impressive move. You can go back in the show and we've been looking at that since mid-December of last year. So over the last 2.5 months or so, seen a really impressive move, a lot of strength, especially in the face of the dollar. Dollar continues to hold value. Usually you see gold moving, having positive correlation or negative correlation, depending on how you want to look at it, with the dollar, meaning dollar goes up, or I guess the term would be inverse correlation. Dollar goes up, gold drops, dollar goes down, gold rises. We've been looking for a variety of different reasons to see those two starting to move together. That very much has started to happen. We're not like gold breakout zone, people freaking out. But we're pushing up against this 1350 level on gold here. And that's really intriguing because that's been a very big resistance point on a technical basis for gold over the last 5 years. So we want to continue to watch that. We've seen an impressive bounce back in oil, still nowhere close to the highs that we've seen over the last year. But, it continues to hang in there, which is interesting, too, because like I said, oil tends to work like gold. It tends to work with the dollar. And there's a million different reasons. There is no one single reason why these things do these moves, right? Why gold has been able to move up while the dollar goes up. I've got my theories on it. I think the world is starting to feel the pinch of some financial strain due to balance sheets just being so bloated. And we're going to talk about that more in the show coming up. I think the interesting thing about this is, you know, I think that you've got a couple different things in the works here. I think that you've got a Pavlovian response built up in markets now, where they're so used to central banks running to the aid of markets over the last 10 years that everybody has just been kind of trained to look past the risk because it hasn't paid, right? Every pullback over the last 10 years has been nothing but a buying opportunity. So that will end. I thought we were in the process of ending that now. I'm still not sold that we're not. But again, you got to remember, these things can take 2 years to play out. Right, everybody forgets Countrywide was really the first casualty of the whole mortgage meltdown. And that happened a year and a half, I believe, before Lehman did. And then after Lehman failed, we still had another 6 months of carnage. So that was a 2-year process. So could we go on to set all time highs? Sure. Yeah, we could. And I'm kind of riding the fence right now. The interesting thing about this bounce back in the market is this isn't the market waking up and realizing everything's okay. All of the economic data we continue to receive, it unequivocally shows global slowing. And not an alarming rate, but in a more than average rate. It doesn't look just like a cool down. A lot of countries, main driving economic countries, Australia, China, Germany, they're not just showing slowdowns, they're actually showing contraction signs. Now, it hasn't been going on long enough to call it a recession, but it's very much something we want to keep an eye on. And like I said, when we see that information, that data deteriorating at the same time you're watching a very impressive market ramp in any year. I mean, to see even off of a decline that we saw at the end of 2018, to see the run-up we've seen since the day after Christmas, it's violent. I mean, that is dramatic. And it, like I said, the thing that concerns us is it is completely contradicting the economic reality in the world. And I think a lot of the things driving that are artificial, meaning that the blackout period for corporate stock buyback purchases expired recently. They've got blackout periods where you can do those operations in the open market. You can buy back your own stock. And there's periods of times that are surrounded by earnings announcements where you can't because they don't want to induce insider trading. So I think you've seen a lot of money flowing into stock buybacks. I think that's been a big thing. And remember, we got to keep an eye on that because that's not a small thing. We're talking up to a trillion. I think we're on pace this year to do something like 1.3 or 1.4 trillion in buybacks, which would make it the biggest buyback year ever, which is impressive because we've had a lot of the biggest buyback years in a row in history in the last 5 years. So this is not just organic. Keep that in mind. And yet that doesn't mean we're running for the hills. And we're going to get into that more. And the next segment I want to talk about is kind of global. But we want to talk about how it all works. Because I think during periods of time like this, I know there's a lot of excitement out there with investors. My job is to try to keep your eye on reality, right? And we want to talk about how it all works. I want to go back over the reality of the situation that we're living in and hopefully give you some more clarity and some more calm and discipline as well, right? Do not get, just like we don't want to panic and sell everything out when the market's down 20, you know, good times are not here again, right? This is not, oh, Katie bar the door, everything with China's fixed, oh, stocks are going nuts. I realize that's the temptation, but that's not the reality. And you know, as always, the reality lies somewhere in between. It's also not doomsday out there, okay? So we want to talk about how it all works. And then kind of a spin off that is examining what the real situation is, because there's so much conflicting data out there. And we want to just kind of address the bedrock of where we're at. And I think that that's really important when we talk about forming an investment thesis. Right. We know what our goal is. When we're sitting here talking to you on the radio today and our clients, our goal is to fund your retirement and give you the retirement that you've been saving for. Right. First and foremost. Second with that, though, is on the investment side, we need to form an investment thesis. And I think that you're better off if that investment thesis is formed in factual information, right, where we're looking at reality for what it is. And that's what we're going to attempt to do here is just redefine where we're at, review where we're at and review the current situation and compare it to with what we're seeing in equity prices and asset prices in general. So that's kind of the name of the game today. And we then want to do a little update at the end of the show on the dirtiest word in investing. So got a great show planned for you. And as always, if the stuff that we're talking to you about, you know, it resonates, if you recognize the fact that a deeper level of thinking needs to be deployed as it relates into managing your assets, if you realize that there are risks out there that people aren't talking about, if you realize that it's not just investing, but there are a lot of societal risks that are new to us here, especially here in the United States and globally, and that you need a portfolio that reflects that, and you understand the old stock bond mix that saw your parents through is probably not going to work for you, give us a call. 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or you can go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. You can go to Bulwark's website. You can Google us, Bulwark Capital Management, Know Your Risk Radio. Check out the podcasts. Check out the information we got on the website. Anyway, you guys know the deal. We've been on here long enough. All right, so we got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. We want to get into how it all works and kind of lay out the global scenario of where we're at. Stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach discuss key investment strategies across several asset classes, not just stocks and bonds. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
I have to tell you, what a relief for my wife and me when we got signed up for long-term care coverage. The more I learned about the fact that nearly 3 out of 4 of us will need some form of long-term care in our retirement, there are so many issues at play. For some people, they can't afford it and they become a burden on their friends and family. For others, you do have money set aside, but it wipes out everything that you've saved. And maybe most importantly, it's about having a plan so that all your children have to do is carry out your wishes. It's not a burden on them. And that's why I love the advice we got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. We started by going to one of Brian's free classes, and that's what I recommend you do to find out about all the different plans they offer. Brian does have a few classes coming up this month. Seats are limited, so sign up now at 525longtermcare.com. You'll get a free copy of Brian's book, too. Go to 525longtermcare.com, 525longtermcare.com.
Volatile markets are never fun, but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Like Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Chances are the defense portion of your portfolio, the bonds, got hit right along with your stocks. So what do you do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right. Welcome back to the show, and thank you for joining us. And we want to get right into it. We want to talk about how it all works. And I think this is something that's so important to keep our eyes on and keep focus on, right? What are we really looking at? And first and foremost, I think it's really important that we divorce ourselves from the habit, the muscle memory that's been built up, you know, really over our entire lifetimes, right? How's the economy doing? All of us look immediately to the stock market. Now, there's an old adage in finance and investing that the stock market isn't the economy. And to a large degree, that's true, right? The way you know this, keep this in mind, the way you know this is because from the years of 2008 to the years of 2016, the economy was historically very bad, okay? There were bright spots, quote-unquote bright spots, but if we look at real employment rates, if we look at marginal productivity, if we look at wages, right? Rising wages. And if we look just at economic growth, economic output, it was the worst or slowest 10 years of growth in our country's history, including the Great Depression. And yet U.S. stock markets tripled over that period of time from the bottoms in 2009. And we've talked about that phenomenon and why that happened. But I think it's important to revisit that, because if you don't know how that happened, you'd be like, well, because corporations were doing well and mainstream street wasn't. It's a failure of capitalism. No, that's not true at all. Well, I suppose you could say in some degrees it was a failure of capitalism, but I don't blame it on capitalism's fault. I blame it on bloated, oversized governments and central banks that are taking way too much of an activist role. And essentially, what we saw in 2008 and 2009 was one of the biggest instances of corporate welfare that we've ever seen in this country's history. Not one of the biggest. And quantitative easing was exactly the same, right? The Federal Reserve and the U.S. government spent essentially, with bailout cost, you're basically looking at about $5 trillion that they created out of thin air. Now, they did it in several different ways. Some of it was paid back. I'm not saying that. But if we just look at the amount of money that was created and pushed into the markets during that period of time, it was about $5 trillion or a little less than one third of GDP, total economic output. Okay, so that's pretty remarkable in and of itself. And that is the explanation for why markets did so well even while the economy didn't. Now, if you've listened to the show before, you're probably sitting there right now going, Zach, I know, we've heard this story. Okay, I got it. But the important thing now is to pull back and sit there and go, okay, wait, what does that mean now? Where are we at now? And the economy has done better, certainly over the last 2 years, without question. But the underpinnings of it all are still very much the same. And what I mean by that is the number one driver of markets is still today and has been for the last 10 years, government action or artificial action, right? We know that a few ways. A, we look at the Federal Reserve balance sheet and we look at the fact that we just said, you know, $5 trillion created out of thin air and force fed into the market. We also look at artificially low interest rates and how that's enabled corporations to buy back their own stock. And everybody goes, well, why is that a problem? And go, well, we're going to get into that in the next segment. But that's a problem because we now have the largest pile of corporate debt ever built up on U.S. companies' balance sheets. And it's also the lowest quality pile of corporate debt ever in the history of the United States. And we, again, we've talked about that on the show before. But another interesting piece of information I encountered over my hiatus, my Mexican hiatus, which was fantastic. But was a detailed look at really what those balance sheets look like and a real picture. That's another thing that we see all the time. Hey, corporate balance sheets never been better. You literally turn on CNBC, you'll hear it three or four times a day. Why they say that? I'll explain to you why they say that. But it's, in my opinion, it is ridiculous. It's short-sighted. I don't think it's untruthful, but I think it's incredibly lazy. And I'll explain to you why that is. But how it all works. So one of the things that I always find helpful in finance is trying to deduce things down to the most simple level, right? Ripping the building down to its foundation and starting there. Because you have to. You get caught up in the noise. You know, you're looking over here, you're looking over there. Because Wall Street's like that. It's like this big, you know, the world of investing is like a carnival, right? We got things popping up over here and the house of horrors and the giant carousel and, you know, just, you know, from scaring you to thrilling you to, you know, it's like walking through a carnival and it's really easy to get distracted. And so one of the things I've learned, one of the disciplines I always look at is what is the actual reality? Let's first define the environment we're in. And here's the environment we're in, and I'm not going to use any hyperbole. We're going to talk about it just in plain, simple facts. Let's look at what happened at the end of 2018, where we suffered one of the worst Decembers in the history of markets. Why? Look, there's never one simple reason why, but I will tell you this. The markets were sitting there looking at the economy slowing down, looking at us being 10 years into a bull market, the longest advance in U.S. history, almost one of the biggest or almost the biggest advance in terms of points or percentage gains on the indexes in U.S. history. And they're looking at economic signs starting to slow down. Like I said, they're not bad by any stretch of the imagination, but they're not red hot. We're not blowing and going. Things have cooled off a little bit. And they've done so much more drastically around the world. At the same time, the Federal Reserve is still in emergency level interest rates. Now, again, stay with me. I know we've talked about this on the show many times. But all it took in that environment, all it took with a little bit less than spectacular growth rates and a little bit, you know, some earnings projections getting walked back by companies, slowdowns, misses on quarter over quarter revenues, just a sign that things were taking a step back, and the Federal Reserve beginning to accelerate the paying off of their balance sheet. Remember, they bought $4.5 trillion worth of stuff. About a year and a half ago, they started a process called quantitative tightening, where they want to start selling that stuff off and normalize and raise rates. Right. Well, first of all, we only got back to 2.5% on the Fed funds rate, which is still 1/3 of the long term average. So way below normal. And we only got about $300 billion into quantitative tightening. And what happened? The market started panicking, right? They started seizing up. Liquidity started just drying up everywhere. And market starts dropping like a rock. We have the worst December ever. And Jerome Powell runs back out there and says, you know, literally 2 weeks before, he's saying the economy is so strong, we must continue to hike interest rates. 2 weeks later, he completely reverses himself. And what have we seen since then? Boom, markets go straight up. Has the economic data changed? Nope. Has the value of the dollar significantly changed? Nope. Are there new economic developments that would justify going from raising rates to pausing rates and stopping quantitative tightening? Nope. What happened? The market went down. And I think that that's really telling. I think it's really telling when we put it in context of the last 10 years. I think it's really telling when we put it in the context of 2008, 2009. And I get in this talk with clients all the time. And I'm torn about it. But we always start at 2008, 2009 because the world changed. And the world changed because universally. Now, the central banks have been meddling in markets for as long as they've existed. But the world significantly changed because the only thing that kept the current system alive in 08, 09 was central banks' ability to print money writ large with no constraints and just start stuffing $100 bills into the holes in the dike, right? And then we look at 2015, 2016. No, I'm jumping ahead. Then we look at the European crisis, quote unquote, 2011. How did they stop that? Mario Draghi coming out and saying, whatever it takes. Meaning that the European Central Bank would print until no end and buy quantitative, you know, via quantitative easing, and they'd even buy corporate bonds. Say they flood the zone with liquidity and boom, we start recovering from there. 2015, 2016 again, we have that parabolic drop in oil prices down to $26 is where we balanced, coming all, or where it's where we settled, coming all the way down from $100 a barrel. And the global system was really going into recession. Federal Reserve stepped in again with language. I mean, there's, you can make an argument they took some action. Maybe they didn't. But China certainly did. China infused $1 trillion equivalent stimulus in 2016. Boom. Bounced us back, right? U.S. was really slowing down going into the election of Trump. And I firmly agree with him. I think if Hillary won the election for a variety of different reasons, I think we already would have been in a recession. We might still be mired in one. What did Trump do, though? He cut taxes, right? Which, look, I am a much bigger fan of that as the form of a stimulus. Nevertheless, it's still a stimulus. Okay? Then that even starts wearing off. We start seeing economic indicators trending south. Federal Reserve has to walk in the middle of December and go, oh, hold on. We're not raising rates anymore. We might even stop quantitative tightening. And the reason why I think that's fascinating is that completely undercuts the story that Jerome Powell and the Fed have been telling for the last year. Right? The economy is so strong and so vibrant. It's not that we think we need to raise rates. So we have to. And yet markets drop 20% and that completely changes everything. And like I said, there's no other data that would have made them change their mind. They're simply reacting to markets. And you might be sitting there going, well, why is that important? Because they're not supposed to care about markets. They're supposed to care about long-term economic health. And a lot of times, like with raising children or your marriage or whatever, doing the right thing probably won't, not sometimes, probably won't result in the most pleasant short-term outcomes. Right? If I'm eating really healthy, it's not the most pleasant thing to do on a Friday night. If I'm working out at 5 a.m, it's not the most pleasant thing to get up. Recessions are the same for economies. Recessions balance imbalances. They burn off excesses. They're not pleasant, but it's right. There's a season for everything. And these central banks would have you believe that there's no longer a need for seasons. It can be summer all the time. And why can it be summer all the time? Well, enter Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Enter the Bernie Sanders. Enter these people talking about modern monetary theory. Because whenever the economy slacks off, we can just have the government print unending amounts of money and fill the gap, which amazingly, that's what they've done over the last 10 years. And so I think it's really important to keep an eye on that. And this is one of the dichotomies of the business that I'm in. Is that could they keep doing that? Yeah, and I think they're going to try. You know, whether we like modern monetary theory or not, whether we care about debts and balance sheets and all that kind of stuff, you know, I don't think anybody really does, not when push comes to shove. Because the one thing that never changes in D.C. is that we spend too much. And we've seen that under both parties. So what does that mean? Well, if you take another step back and a 30,000-foot view, it means that, look, guys, they can keep doing this. And I'm not being tinfoil wearing hat conspiracy theorist when I say that. What I'm saying is that they can continue to print prosperity as long as there is faith in the underlying fiat currency, which every fiat currency in the history of mankind has gone to its intrinsic value, which is zero. But look, that could take place over 200 years. And we're certainly not trying to say that. But the interesting thing to us is that these things are reaching their normal natural bounds. Right, we talked about this on the radio show interviewing Keith Weiner and Brent Johnson, talking about how we're reaching these maximization points where, you know, China has accumulated $40 trillion in debt in the last 10 years. You know, we know that they can't sustain that. The debt servicing costs, debt servicing costs on their debt already amounts to 25% of their economy, which is unbelievable. Right. And so at some point, these things will break. Where? Who knows? But if you want to understand why I don't want clients sitting there watching markets like they used to, it's because they don't mean what they used to mean. In the 1960s, when we looked at markets, and to a great degree, even in the 80s and somewhat the 90s, even when we looked at markets, they told us something about economies. Now, the number one thing they tell us is who's printing the most money. And like I said, look at the last 2 months as a perfect example of that. The markets literally have been moving in opposite directions of earnings expectations, revenue expectations, balance sheet quality, and economic data. Literally inverse directions. And why is that? Well, like I said, Powell walks back the interest rate hikes, which were kind of hanging over like a sword of Damocles over the market. And China pumped again. It's one of their biggest stimuluses they've done in January. One of the biggest stimulus operate. You know, they did a combined tax cut. They did, I think they did a slight release on capital controls. Don't quote me on that. The PBOC pumped into balance sheets again. Anyway, same old story. These aren't natural forces. It wasn't that the market was overreacting and everybody realized everything's okay. No, what the market was reacting to is still very much in line. I mean, it's still right there. But it's the market finally, you know, these things grow over time. And I think what the market's doing really here is it's showing you its hands. It's saying, look, economic data hasn't mattered for 10 years. Why do we expect it now? Number one driver of asset prices has been central bank activities. And if things are slowing down, that means good times are here again. It means that bad news is good news. We don't care how the markets are doing. Just keep flooding it with liquidity, baby. And that's one of the really, really interesting things about this whole dynamic we got going on with China that we'll talk a little bit now in the next segment. But the reason why I think that's a big deal is that these central bankers have been working in unison, right? We hit this issue and these guys print, and then we switch to these guys, and they each take turns. But what you're watching here is the increase in political fracturing, right? Not just here in our own country, but on a globalized basis. You're looking at the rise of populism, which I think is becoming an overused term really quickly. Bear with me. I agree with you, but it's true. This us versus them mentality here in American politics, we're seeing it on a global basis. We're seeing it in Europe. And if politicians truly have to start doing what's best for their own constituency rather than just maintaining the status quo, you're going to see this cooperation between central banks start to deteriorate and start to lose its grip on market forces. And I think that I firmly believe that that process has started. Now, how that ends up in market directions, you're not going to hear me. You know, I could sit there, like I told you, I go, you know, I think this is the beginning of a breakdown. I'm still not convinced that that's not the case, but this bounce back has been impressive. I continue to be amazed at the way that central banks get markets to look past reality. And valuations just keep rising to more and more stratospheric levels. And balance sheets keep getting more and more bloated. And I've got no clue what the wind is going to do. I have no clue when that gust of wind is going to come that's going to provide that last push. Or what we refer to in the world of economics and finance, that Minsky moment. Right? Because that's the way markets work. People think that markets are all constantly collecting data and constantly pricing it in. That's not historically what happens. That's what they're supposed to do. But markets actually are extrapolation devices. It's people extrapolating results. And that's how bubbles happen, is because the extrapolation goes way past the reality. And to be fair, guys, and this is why I always say that just because something is inevitable doesn't mean it's imminent. It's because I'm amazed it's gone on this long. But when we want to know what's happening, take a step back and look at the consistencies. What got us out of 08-09? Government and Fed intervention. What, quote unquote, saved the European crisis? European Central Bank's intervention in 2011. What stopped the oil deluge and the global recession that very much looked like it was starting in 2015, end of 2015, beginning of 2016? It was Fed reiterating easy pace on the rate hiking schedule, promising not to be too aggressive, and China dropping a record-breaking stimulus into the global markets. Okay, what about this last time? Once again, a China stimulus coupled with a slowdown, the Fed coming out and saying, not just we might, we are going to drastically reduce our plans to cut interest rates, right? So every single time, what I'm pointing to is that the things that saved us were government and central bank interventions. And they're artificial. And those central banks, the other thing I think it's interesting this time is in the past when we saw these infusions of capital and these guys coming to the rescue, you'd see the economic data start to turn up. You're not seeing that this time. Again, doesn't mean it won't, but what it means is it's not responding as acutely as it had in the past, which means that I think that we're starting to see the efficacy the impact that all of this printed money, I think it's starting to wear off. And remember, you think of the markets like people or like patients. You know, over a period of time, tolerance adds up, right? Medications quit becoming as effective. People talk about superbugs, right? Antibiotics. It's just the way these things work. It's like a natural law of gravity. And so I'm not saying the end is here. I'm not saying to hide under your bed. We never do that. And I talk about it all the time. What I'm saying is that you're starting to see that effect wear off. Not in the markets. They're still able to jack up asset prices. But I'm saying, look at the underlying economic activity. And this is what you'd expect, because if the whole way you boost economies is to get people to take on more debt and more liabilities, you can do that until their balance sheets just can't facilitate more debt. And you're starting to see that happen in student loans, right? You got a record amount of delinquencies in student loans, and that number is skyrocketing. Auto loans. You got a record of delinquency in auto loans that we haven't seen since the 2007. Home prices have stalled out. I don't think it's because the economy's coming apart. I just think that this whole way of stimulating economies by, I mean, it's just a natural limit, right? You know, you can't have average middle class people walking around $4 million in debt making 60 grand a year. There's just limits to these things. And so I think that's what you're starting to see, that central banks are starting to push on a string. Now, I think the natural answer to that is not going to be these people get religion and realize that we've got to start doing things in a more responsible and sustainable manner. I think you're going to start to see them with fiscal stimulus, meaning that they're going to start passing stimulus packages and build bridge building to nowhere and, you know, paying people to dig holes and fill them back in. But do not sit there and watch these market bounces and think this means that everything's fine, that December was a panic and this is the reality. I think it's actually the inverse. But one of the other possibilities we got to think about, and this is where clients step in, they go, well, if you think that, Zach, that makes sense to me. Why don't we just sell everything out and sit on the side? Look, because the other thing is that that's what I think. Look what they've been able to do to markets over the last 10 years. Right. Whether it's real or not, it doesn't really matter. That money still shows up in your account. I'm not saying it doesn't. But the realities of where we're at, we must be important to them, where we must pay attention to them, because if we do not, you know, we may not think they're important, but they'll take that personally and they'll show they're important. So, you know, one of our jokes around the office is you may not believe in gravity, but it believes in you. And you know, the people sitting there going, Zach, I've been hearing you say that for 2 years. Yeah. Yeah. But again, we didn't say to sell off everything. Why? Because we know you can't predict these things. We just know you got to manage your risk. And that's why that, you know, the bond replacement strategy we like works so much. You know, when markets are going up like this, great. We're getting 50 to 60% of that upside. We're insured against loss. We're not paying a management fee on it. And we're making more money. But if they don't, if markets don't keep going up and the roof caves in, which is not if, it's when, and I've got no clue when, you're not going to get that out of me. You'd be an idiot to try to make that prognostication. Because it can happen anytime, especially when things are this overdone. But you need to have a strategy in place, and sitting in bonds isn't going to do it. Because we all think about bad economic outcomes as market prices going down. What if it ends up in a really inflationary environment? I'm not talking about hyperinflation. You'll see bonds get slaughtered and stocks continue to go up, at least for a while. And that goes back into our strategy, is we've got to build plans and strategies that work regardless of what happens. And that bond portfolio, like I said, it's a ticking time bomb. It might cause you more pain than the stocks you own. And if you're not planning for that, if you don't have some layer of your retirement, you know, savings that is safeguarded against loss, if you're relying on bonds or CDs as your protection, you need to find a new umbrella. And not just because I'm pitching it to you. It's because it works. And like I say all the time, if we can pay less and take less risk and make more money, it's not if we should do it. That's the answer. That's it. And if that's something you're interested in, give us a call. 866-779-RISK and 866-779-RISK. You don't need to meet with me. We can email back and forth. We can do a phone consultation. We can just even just, you know, just sit there and go, hey, this is what you currently have. This is what we've done. This is what it costs. This is the performance. But just take another look, guys. Take another look. And if you're sitting there going, no, Zach, I like this run up in the stocks. Great. When the market's going up like this, our clients are making more money than the typical stock bond portfolio. That's the whole point. We're just taking a lot less risk, and we're paying about half the amount of fees to do it. And why? Because interest rates are so low, you can't make any money in bonds. And yet the average investor's got 40 to 50, 60% of their money sitting in bonds, paying them nothing, paying the advisor more to manage them than they've made. There's just a better way to do things. So anyway, we got to run, take a quick break. We'll be right back. But as always, like I said, give us a call. You can email us. You don't have to talk to us. We're here to help. It's not going to be an arm-twisting type scenario. Hey, this is what we do. Here's how it's different. Here's what it costs. Boom. You like it? Great. Become a client. If you don't, hopefully we've given you some education. Hey, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, and see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Story Monson with my financial advisor, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. And Zach, what I love about you guys is your focus on risk management.
Well, Dory, we're a fiduciary and a holistic retirement planning firm. Our goals are simple. Get our clients the highest returns with the least amount of risk and cost.
I know they're normally used for safety, but how risky are bonds right now?
If a significant portion of your retirement portfolio is in cash or bonds, that just doesn't work in this low interest rate environment on the verge of inflation. You need a bond replacement strategy.
I gotta tell you, you have to read it. Zach's brand new version of Common Sense Investing. You'll learn that bond replacement strategy, learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call now, get your free copy, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com. Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And we are back. Thank you for sticking with us. Want to get into kind of tie up what we were talking about last segment, keeping an eye on what's real. And again, I want to reiterate that it's not that everything is bad. Not saying that, that is not true. And truth be told, the economy looks better than it did in some ways on the surface than it did 2 years ago when Trump came into office. But the reason that it really goes back to human behavior, right? The reason that economic conditions do not maintain stagnation, well, unless you're Japan over the last 30 years, I guess that's a different example. But in general, is because of human behavior, meaning that the longer things are good, the more people keep discounting that into financing and payment plans and all these different things, right? And excesses start to build up because they believe that, you know, the tide's never going to go out. And it's just that natural rhythm of human behavior and human interactions in financial markets that create these, you know, these situations where both you get to the top of cycles and things are overbought and cash flows can no longer sustain debt loads. And, you know, the inverse is also true at the bottoms. Everybody's throwing the baby out the bathwater and panicking and, oh, it's never going to come back. And those things don't sustain either. Because when everybody thinks it's horrible and it's never going to come back, they don't want to take on any debt. They just want to pay debt off. And naturally, those conditions that created the problem, they deteriorate. That's one of the issues that I have with current central bank policy is they will not let uncomfortable economic situations, you know, for the most part, last for any more than a couple weeks until they pull out the guns because they got to keep asset prices up. And so one of the biggest interesting things to me is we can look on the periphery and see these historic levels of imbalances in our economy. But what we also know is that we're not seeing the whole story. You know, go back to 08, 09, or even in 2000, right? We knew that internet stocks were expensive. We didn't know that companies like WorldCom and Enron were frauds. And again, that's just another part of human behavior, right? As soon as things start going down and economies start to weaken, everybody starts looking at cash flows and go, what do you mean? Hold on. GDP's dropped by 20% in the last 12 months. You're telling me your revenue has gone up at the same time, even though energy prices have dropped by 30 or 40%? That's not possible. And then they start looking into financial transactions and boom, you find a fraud like Enron or WorldCom. Same in 2008-09. A lot of people knew real estate was overvalued. They didn't realize that AIG was writing credit default swaps on mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations. They didn't realize that these companies had so many off-balance sheet liabilities because they didn't have to report AAA-rated debt on their balance sheets. Right, there are all these excesses, Bernie Madoff. There are all these excesses that get hidden because prices keep going up. And the question that I've got is when we sit back and I want to read this, remember talking about the biggest misnomers out there in finance. One of the things you're going to hear Mr. Jim Cramer talk about all the time, who I go after. One of my other clients told me, hey, you shouldn't keep apologizing for it. Well, you know what? You're right. Because nothing makes me angrier than charlatans. And we talk about this again multiple times, but nothing makes me more angry than charlatans professing things that are not true. Okay, because it affects real people's lives. I don't even think these people are trying to do that. I don't think Jim Cramer's trying to mislead anybody. I just think it gives you a good insight to remember these are just people, A, and most of them that are telling you all this good news are trying to sell you something. You go, well, Zach, you're trying to sell me something too. Well, I guess you could say that in a roundabout way. But that's one of the reasons that I point to the facts and that we don't just rely on rhetoric. And one of those facts is, okay, let's just address one. If you turn on CNBC for any period of time, you're going to hear about corporate balance sheets have never had more cash on them. They've never been better. Okay, here's the truth, okay? This was a study that was released by somebody by the name of Lisa Abramovitz, who's really sharp, who I follow on Twitter. And she works for Bloomberg Radio. Worked in the industry for a long time, and she published this study that was, what they're saying about companies in the S&P 500, when they say balance sheets are in the best position they've ever been in, that's true to a degree. Corporations on the S&P 500 have more cash on their balance sheet than at any other time in history, okay? But here's the catch. Virtually all of that, okay, 95% of that cash is held by 5% of the corporations on the S&P 500. If we look at the other 95% of the companies on the S&P 500, they've got the lowest levels of cash to debt that they've had since 2004. So when they tell you that the S&P has never been more flush with cash, balance sheets have never been healthier, you look at them and go, well, yeah, for 5% of the S&P, that's true, right? Again, we're seeing in markets the same thing that we're seeing in society. A record wage gap, right? This great uneven distribution. And on the surface, we look at it, we go, record levels of cash, that's good. What's the reality underneath the surface? Well, it's the inverse. 95% of corporations have not had, and this includes 2007. 2008, they have never had less cash to debt than they've got now since 2004, 15 years. So when we're telling you that it's the best it's ever been, that's 5% of the story. We're looking at the 5%, ignoring 95. And then you add that into economic momentum we're seeing here. And this is what I'm trying to tell you is that we need to be especially careful now because markets reflect liquidity being pumped into systems. They're not reflecting economic realities. They're just not. And that data point right there tells it to you. So what does this all mean? What it means is if you're relying on the same type of portfolio where we got record levels of debt, never had more debt, we're using that as security against our equity positions, which are historically overvalued because of their access to cheap debt, and that's what we're building a portfolio on, that it ain't going to work. And it hasn't so far. And if you need a new idea, if you need a new approach, if you need a greater level of security, pay less fees, take less risk, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Go to knowyourriskradio.com, Bulwark Management's website. You can Google us, sign up for the podcast, sign up for the newsletter. Anyway, we got to run. It's been a great show. Look forward to seeing you guys next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.